When did that start to change? When did the thing that everyone sort of recognized as sort of a liberal bias start to shift into something harder than that, into what you call a knee-jerk activist and even scolding quality?
Well, I think it was cumulative. I don't think it was one event. I mean, I think part of it was Trump's election. You know, I think like every newsroom, every legacy media newsroom, we were shocked, disturbed, distraught, really troubled. We assumed Hillary Clinton was going to win, and she didn't. And it was really an unsettling experience. But I also think, to me, it revealed that we didn't really understand a lot of what was going on in America, that we were out of touch. But I think also we kind of locked down after a while. I think after a while we started covering Trump in a way that like a lot of legacy news organizations, that we were trying to damage his presidency, to even find anything we could to harm him. And I think what we latched on to was Russia collusion, like a lot of news organizations, which was, as I write, sort of catnip, although it was just rumors and a lot of it based on pretty shoddy documents or evidence. It wasn't really solid. But I think it was compelling. And for us, you know, I think a lot of newspapers, you know, use documents or anonymous sources. We really latched on to Adam Schiff. He was like our muse to the Trump collusion story. We had him on constantly, a lot. I think I counted 25 times. You know, and in most of those conversations, he sort of alluded to evidence he may have had or sort of teased out, yeah, Russia, you know, he was colluding or the campaign was colluding with Russia. And then the Mueller report came out and no collusion. And, you know, I think we sort of learned the story kind of disappeared. But to me, that was like a time for like, what went wrong? Why did we miss this? Mm. Like, you know, despite our feelings about Trump, this is a story we should have sort of treated differently.
And what is happening, everyone? Welcome on into the Check Your Brain podcast. For my Patreon people, thank you for listening and subscribing to the podcast. You get this podcast Monday, April 15th. The rest of you are watching or listening to this as early as Wednesday, the 17th. So if you are on the free podcast platforms, welcome. Hope you enjoy the show. Subscribe to the podcast. Give me a 5-star rating. Tell a friend. Tell 5 friends. I don't know. Find me on social media. Let me know what you think of the podcast. Like, dislike. And regardless what you think, I'm going to continue putting out podcast content for you going forward. But again, if you do like the show, I have plenty more content, archived content over at my Patreon at patreon.com/Tony Mazur. Good to have you folks with me or back with me here on the podcast. And today's show is a little bit, I don't want to say a continuation of a show I did a couple of weeks ago, but it's a companion piece with it. So a couple of weeks ago, I read a piece from National Public Radio, or NPR, as you may know it. NPR put a thing out about how young men, usually young white men, are deciding that maybe pornography and masturbation are not the best things for me. Maybe I should stop looking at naked women and or men, I don't know, having sex on camera at the couple of clicks of a mouse or a couple of swipes of my thumb and finding porn. Should probably stop looking at that and stop playing with myself and maybe find a suitor. Maybe find a woman, maybe find a partner, using the gender neutral term, a partner. Maybe they want to start a family. Maybe they want to get married. They want to share a life with somebody. Instead, NPR says, no, you shouldn't do that, because if you are stopping that, there's a bad pipeline to election deniers and COVID deniers and QAnon and Donald Trump supporters and white nationalism. And I'm thinking, So it's not necessarily a binary choice here that I think you can, believe it or not, you can stop masturbating and not join the alt-right. You know, that is possible, NPR, but they look at it as a binary choice. It's either you join no wanks, and now all of a sudden you're having QAnon flags and talking about horrible, dangerous conspiracy theories about the 2020 election, or you can tell children that they should go on Pornhub and keep masturbating and do that for the rest of their lives and not have a family? And I'm like, yeah, it doesn't need to be a binary choice. So I discussed that a little bit, didn't necessarily talk more about NPR, but I talked about the topic of masturbation, about what it's like to get away from that. And today's episode is not so much that, it's just more of a let's rip on NPR podcast. So last week, there was a man named Yuri Berliner. I think his name is Berliner, Yuri Berliner. He put out a piece in Barry Weiss's Free Press, I believe it's called. And it's talking about NPR. He's been at NPR since 1999. And the title of the piece says, I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust. Says Yuri Berliner, a veteran at the public radio institution, says the network lost its way when it started telling listeners how to think. So here's the piece. This went kind of viral, but it went viral in a way that it should have woken up more people. And instead, a lot of the left-wing people are like, yeah, no, that's why I like NPR, because they have a left-wing slant. And right-wing people are like, yeah, that's why I stopped listening, or I never listened to you because you had a left-wing stance. So there's a lot more echo chamber type of stuff in this piece. You know the stereotype of the NPR listener, an EV-driving, Wordle-playing, tote-bag-carrying coastal elite. It doesn't precisely describe me, but it's not far off. I'm Sarah Lawrence, educated, was raised by a lesbian peace activist mother. I drive a Subaru, and Spotify says my listening habits are most similar to people in Berkeley. I fit the NPR mold. I'll cop to that. So when I got a job here 25 years ago, I never looked back. As a senior editor on the business desk where news is always breaking, we've covered upheavals in the workplace, supermarket prices, social media, and AI. It's true NPR has always had a liberal bent, but during most of my tenure here, an open-minded, curious culture prevailed. We were nerdy, but not knee-jerk activist or scolding. In recent years, however, that has changed. Today, those who listen to NPR or read its coverage online find something different: the distilled worldview of a very small segment of the U.S. population. Excuse me. If you're a conservative, you'll read this and say, duh, it's always been this way. But it hasn't. Now, I'm going to stop that there and show you a tweet of one Tony Mazur from December 10th, 2010, that says, ever notice the people with a coexist bumper sticker on their fender have an NPR sticker right next to it? So it almost seems to me that this stereotype has been going on for a long time because of who these people are. And they claim that they're the most open-minded people, but they really are not. And we'll read a little bit more of this, and I'll comment more on it. But it's just funny how you say, well, that we fit the mold, but we've never really been this way. Except you have. Except you have been this way. And this is why this stereotype has prevailed for probably the whole time this guy's been here. But what he's going to talk about is it has accelerated in recent years now. So here's what he says. For decades since its founding in 1970, a wide swath of America tuned into NPR for reliable journalism and gorgeous audio pieces with birds singing in the Amazon. Millions came to us for conversations that exposed us to voices around the country and the world radically different from our own, engaging precisely because they were unguarded and unpredictable. No image generated more pride within NPR than the farmer listening to Morning Edition from his or her tractor at sunrise. No one did that. Are you telling me Farmer Brown in his John Deere tractor, who woke up at the ass crack of dawn, jumped in his tractor and was like, welcome to NPR Morning Edition. My name is Tony. I'm here with you. They didn't do that. It was never a thing. And if it was, it's five people total ever. Not enough for me to actually discuss it more. Back in 2011, although NPR's audience tilted a bit to the left, it still bore a resemblance to America at large. 26% of listeners described themselves as conservative, 23% in the middle of the road, and 37% as liberal. By 2023, the picture was completely different. Only 11% described themselves as very or somewhat conservative, 21% as middle of the road, and 67% of listeners said that they are very or somewhat liberal. We weren't just losing conservatives, we were also losing moderates and traditional liberals. An open-minded spirit no longer exists at NPR, and now predictably we don't have an audience that reflects America. That wouldn't be a problem for an openly polemic news outlet serving a niche audience, but for NPR, which purports to consider all things, It's devastating for both its journalism and its business model. Like many unfortunate things, the rise of advocacy took off with Donald Trump. As in many newsrooms, his election in 2016 was greeted at NPR with a mixture of disbelief, anger, and despair. Just to note, I eagerly voted against Trump twice, but felt we were obliged to cover him fairly. But what began as a tough, straightforward coverage of a belligerent, truth-impaired president veered toward efforts to damage or topple the Trump presidency. Persistent rumors that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia over the election became the catnip that drove reporting. At NPR, we hitched our wagon to Trump's most visible antagonist, Representative Adam Schiff. Schiff, who was the top Democrat in the House Intelligence Committee, became NPR's guiding hand, its ever-present muse. By my count, NPR hosts interviewed Schiff 25 times about Trump and Russia. During many of these conversations, Schiff alluded to purported evidence of collusion. These Schiff talking points became the drumbeat of NPR news reports. But when the Mueller report found no credible evidence of collusion, NPR's coverage was notably sparse. Russiagate quietly faded from our programming. It is one thing to swing and miss on a major story. Unfortunately, it happens. You follow the wrong leads, you get misled by sources you trusted, you're emotionally invested in a narrative, and bits of circumstantial evidence never add up. It's bad to blow a big story. What's worse is to pretend it never happened, to move on with no mea culpas, no self-reflection, especially when you expect high standards of the transparency from public figures and institutions, but don't practice those standards yourself. That's what shatters trust and endangers cynicism about the media. Russiagate was not only NPR's only miscue. In October 2020, the New York Post published the explosive report about the laptop Hunter Biden abandoned at a Delaware computer shop containing emails about his sordid business dealings. With the election only weeks away, NPR turned a blind eye. Here's how NPR's managing editor for news at the time explained the thinking. We don't want to waste our time on stories that are not really stories, and we don't want to waste listeners' and readers' time on stories that are just pure distractions. But it wasn't just pure distraction or product of Russian disinformation, as dozens of former and current intelligence officials suggested. The laptop did belong to Hunter Biden. Its contents revealed its connection to the corrupt world of the multi-million-dollar influence peddling and its possible implications for his father. The laptop was newsworthy, but the timeless journalistic instinct of following a hot story lead was being squelched. During a meeting with the colleagues, I listened to, as one of NPR's best and most fair-minded journalists said, it was good we weren't following the laptop story because it would help Trump. Now, it goes on. I could probably read a little bit more, you know, if you want to read it, the rest of it on your own. But I figured for the podcast to talk a little bit about it and that veneer of what NPR was and who they were. So NPR, really, now this is me now. This is not Yuri Berliner. This is Tony Mazur talking right now, if you're only listening. NPR, in my opinion, got away for decades of pushing left-wing gobbledygook under the guise of, no, they're NPR. They're fair and balanced. They're right down the middle. They report the news. New York Times had that for a long time as well. Washington Post probably as well. And I think the biggest one was CNN. I remember when my first job out of high school was I was working at a sub shop that's here in the Midwest where I'm broadcasting from, which is called Penn Station East Coast Subs. So I got a job there, and I started the first day this location opened. And so we were kind of getting a grand tour of all the different things. And again, it's like a dumb high school type of job. I'm 18 years old and I'm making sandwiches and French fries. And so they have over at the one station where you have the fountain drinks and the lemons for your water and your iced tea. Right above the sugar packets was one of those like old Magnavox or Philips TVs that was hovering overhead. And so they said, when we're open during a ball game, for example, a baseball game, football game, we'll put the game on, but we want to make sure during the day we're not going to offend certain people with programming. Like, we're not going to put some like comedy show that could offend somebody going, well, I was really offended. All I did was I got a sub and I heard bad language. So they wanted something that wasn't going to offend them, their sensibilities, but also not divide them politically. So this was my general manager at the time said, when there's not a ball game on, we're going to have CNN on because Fox News is too far right for people and MSNBC is too far left. CNN seems like it's right down the middle. So we rather just have people just give the news, just an impartial view of the news. Now, even I knew at 18 that that was BS, but I kind of went along with it. Okay, whatever. What am I going to do? I just got this job, need a couple of bucks to afford my my chain wallets and whatever I was getting in high school, my Vans tennis shoes or something. So I didn't question it, but I realized that there were a lot of people up until recently that thought CNN was a very impartial news outlet. The C stood for central, centrist. It's the centrist news outlet, even though many of us remember during the 1990s, people called it the Communist or the Clinton News Network. They were very favorable on William Jefferson Clinton in those days and his wife. But I really felt that they had that veneer for decades to get along with it with NPR of, no, see. It's just a bunch of people who are whispering. You know, they do whisper talk. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Whisper Talk on NPR. My name is Tony, and we're going to be reading a book from Bret Easton Ellis. That's old Family Guy bit, but so it's not mine. But I thought what was kind of interesting was how NPR really, they started pushing left without people realizing it. And I think many of those outlets, the New York Times, the CNNs, and NPRs, by the time Trump did roll around, that it kind of showed their hand. Now, when you think about left-wing bias in news, you'll even hear boomers, you'll hear a lot of people say, you know, when I was a kid, we had Walter Cronkite, and Walter Cronkite gave us the news. He was the guy that you knew at 6:30, whatever time it was on. The evening news, I am Walter Cronkite, here's the news, and here's what's going on in Vietnam, and President Nixon, blah, 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 blah. And I think even to this day, if you talk to even some conservative, like boomer cons, they would tell you, yeah, boy, back in my day, we still had Walter Cronkite giving the news. People don't realize that Walter Cronkite was a far leftist. And really, when you look at the Tet Offensive and other stories coming out of Vietnam, many say that his propaganda and the propaganda pushed on CBS News at that time changed the direction and the public perception of the war. And ever since then, from Desert Storm to the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan in the 2000s to what we've seen with drone bombings and, oh, wait, no, Obama never had a scandal. That's right. I forgot about that. But it's kind of funny how all that seemed to really work itself out. But it is funny when they said that in, what was it, 2023, when Elon Musk ended up buying Twitter, changed it to X, and then labeled NPR as state-affiliated media. Here was the statement that was put out there. This was by, what's his name, John, I can't see this, my face is in the way, John Lansing, says, we were disturbed to see last night that Twitter has labeled NPR as state-affiliated media, a description that, per Twitter's own guidelines, does not apply to NPR. NPR and our member stations are supported by millions of listeners. See, this is all garbage. This is all the same stuff we've been hearing for decades. NPR and our member stations are supported by millions of listeners who depend on us for independent, fact-based journalism we provide. NPR stands for freedom of speech. Ooh, and holding the powerful accountable. Ooh, it is unacceptable for Twitter to label us this way. A vigorous, vibrant, free press is essential to the health of our democracy. Well, we all know, and if you listen to my podcast, I don't want your perverted version of democracy, whatever you mean by that. Because if you're in favor of jailing political opponents, if you're not going to put out certain stories because you don't want it to damage the person that you are trying to prop up politically, you are no longer a free press anymore. You are state-affiliated media. When the Russiagate stuff that was popping up that I had mentioned with Adam Schiff, why do you have him on that many times? Because they wanted it to be true. They wanted that story to be true so, so bad. And I love the fact that the scab has been ripped off. Let me get back a little bit more to this article by Yuri Berliner. As I take a sip of my beverage again. When the essential facts of the Post reporting were confirmed and the emails verified, this is talking about the Hunter Biden laptop, independently for about a year and a half later, we could have fessed up to our misjudgment, but like Russian collusion, we didn't make the hard choice of transparency. Politics also intruded into NPR's COVID coverage, most notably in reporting on the origin of the pandemic. One of the most dismal aspects of COVID for journalism is how quickly it defaulted to ideological storylines. For example, there was Team Natural Origins supporting the hypothesis that the virus came from a wild animal market in Wuhan, China. And on the other side, Team Lab Leak leaned into the idea that the virus escaped from a Wuhan lab. The lab leak theory came in for rough treatment almost immediately, dismissed as racist or a right-wing conspiracy theory. Anthony Fauci and former NIH head Francis Collins, representing the public health establishment, were its most central or notable critics. And that was enough for NPR. We became fervent members of Team Natural Origin, even declaring that the lab leak had been debunked by scientists. I'll get to that here in a little bit. But that wasn't the case. When the word first broke of a mysterious virus in Wuhan, a number of leading virologists immediately suspected it could have leaked from a lab there conducting experiments on bat coronaviruses. That was in January 2020, during calmer moments before a global pandemic had been declared and before fear spread and politics intruded. Reporting on a possible lab leak soon became radioactive. Fauci and Collins apparently encouraged the March publication of an influential scientific paper known as The Proximal Origin of SARS-CoV-2. The authors wrote that they didn't believe any type of laboratory-based scenario was plausible, but the lab leak hypothesis wouldn't die, understandably so. In private, even some of the scientists who penned the article dismissing it sounded a different tune. One of the authors, Andrew Rambaut, an evolutionary biologist from the Edinburgh University, wrote to his colleagues, "I literally swivel day by day thinking it's a lab escape or natural." Over the course of the pandemic, a number of investigative journalists made compelling, if not conclusive, cases for the lab leak. But at NPR, we weren't about to swivel or even tiptoe away from the insistence, which we backed the natural origin theory. We didn't budge when the Energy Department, the federal agency with the most expertise about laboratories and biological research, concluded, albeit with low confidence, that the lab leak was most likely an explanation of the emergence of the virus. Instead, we introduce our coverage at the development on February 28, 2023, by asserting confidently that the scientific evidence overwhelmingly points to a natural origin for the virus. So again, it goes on and on and on in this piece. And I could read even more of it, but again, read it out at your own. All it did was it confirmed for a lot of us to go, you are propaganda. You are no longer NPR. You are none of that. And you do not represent America. You don't represent the average American. This is why they got away from it. People should understand, though, those who work in journalism, those who work in media, they're not low-income people who wanted to put on a fedora with the press card in the side and become a roving reporter. They're usually people from upper middle class to upper class backgrounds who have the ability to, after college, move back home with mommy and daddy. And mommy and daddy can support them and put food on their table and give them gas to fill up and go to work. And they can have a couple of those lean years until they either move or get a big job in media. It's a white collar job in a white collar industry. And that's why you're not going to see a lot of like hard urban, you know, like Hispanics or blacks from like rougher areas in it, because it's a real, real classist field. In a lot of ways. So I want to talk about a couple of these things here that have popped up and things to mention and why it's not representative of America. So here we have the head of NPR. The new head of NPR has pronouns in her bio. This is according to Peter Boghossian. What does this make you believe her more or less when she claims she's committed to having ideological diversity in NPR's programming? So you say, oh, the head of NPR has pronouns. Well, look, Tony, I understand in the LinkedIn days that this is the new virtue signal to show that you are standing with our trans brothers and sisters. And yeah, it is. That's all it is. It's a social justice warrior type of thing. It's like, look, see what I'm doing. I'm doing something. I put she, her in my pronoun bio. It really doesn't do anything other than peacocking. What it is it's a bat signal to your fellow woke individuals in this business by saying, look how inclusive I am. Look at my pronouns. Aren't my pronouns great? See, I've got pronouns. You have pronouns. We all have pronouns, everybody. Some are she, her. Some are he, him. Some are they, them. Yeah. Except it goes a little worse than that. How is the head of NPR? You want to try to, we need to clean some things up and go back to our days of journalistic integrity. Except the head of NPR, here she is. This is Catherine Mayer or Maher. There she is during COVID, I assume, I hope it's not today, where she's wearing a mask outside and a Biden for president grandpa hat, as she calls it. The best part of AZGOTV is my Biden grandpa hat. And she's walking around by herself outside wearing a COVID mask because, you know, COVID, as we've all learned now in the past couple of years, COVID was very deadly for you when you're walking by yourself and you're hiking, or even worse when you're by yourself in your car. Here are a couple of other things from the head of NPR right now. I mean, sure, looting is counterproductive. So this is the summer of George, the summer of love of 2020. I mean, sure, looting is counterproductive, but it's hard to be mad about the protests not prioritizing the private property of a system of oppression founded on treating people's ancestors as private property. And here's another one from around that time. I too wish Hillary wouldn't use the language of boy and girl. It's erasing language for non-binary people. So that's your head of NPR. Your head of NPR is a far-left social justice warrior activist who probably doesn't like Joe Biden all that much, though would vote for Joe Biden. She's probably more of an Elizabeth Warren supporter who wears her mask, probably still wears her mask in April of 2024, was excusing the riot. So I'm assuming if she's wearing a COVID mask that she was pro-team lockdown, lock everything down, don't leave your house. See, have your sip your wine, have your dog take a dump in the house, whatever. You don't go outside. I swear to God, you want grandma killed. But if you are going to go outside, make sure you protest in honor of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Tamir Rice and Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and Freddie Gray and Philando Castillo and all these other people that Rodney King and OJ. Oh, well, we'll get to OJ in a second. So if you're she's pro lockdown, but pro loot and riot and protest and everything in the streets. And oh, by the way, use gender inclusive language. So you're going to tell me the head of NPR now is going to be an impartial person at the head of your organization that is supposed to be impartial when you see her with a clear Joe Biden for president hat, COVID mask, excusing looting, and talking about pronouns and gender inclusive language? Yeah, sure. That represents America as a whole. Yeah, absolutely. So I want to talk about a couple of other stories that have popped up that I wanted to mention, because the P in NPR really should is not public, it's propaganda. It's National Propaganda Radio. Their podcasts, their articles, way long before November 2016, were full-on social justice warrior, woke dogma, whatever you want to call it, a political correctness, all that kind of stuff. And they would do these weird articles that you almost wonder, are you using them for bait? Is this a bait tactic? Like, are you trying to fish out who is going to be upset with this? Or do you really believe some of this nonsense you're pushing? And one of them was, there was an NPR, I wish I had it in front of me, but I was just thinking about it. There was a piece in the NPR pushed about time. I think I had it in my notes somewhere. It was how being prompt, being on time is a form of white supremacy. Oh, yeah. Well, it's white supremacy to be on time for work or on time for an engagement or a party or to an appointment at the doctor's office, that Black and Brown Americans don't have the luxury of, because they're up all night thinking about the KKK and white supremacy, that they're tossing and turning in their sleep and they're not getting enough sleep right now. And the fact that white people get 8 hours of sleep and are able to wake up in enough time, take a shower, make breakfast, get coffee, and get to work on time, that's because of white supremacy. Oh yeah, that's the stuff that NPR pushes right now. In fact, here's something from my local NPR affiliate. This is WCPN here in Cleveland, Ohio. I almost got a job with them. Thank God I didn't. And I wouldn't have had one after they hear podcasts like this. Suspensions, I covered this on a recent podcast, by the way, on my Patreon. Suspensions are rising in Ohio schools with uneven impacts on students. Now, what does that mean, of course? That means Actually, I think I quote tweeted it here, if I can find my tweet. I can't find it. But it was something along the lines of, I'm going to save you folks a click on this one. They're blaming suspensions on teachers, white teachers who don't want to deal and be disciplinarians in schools. And they're sending black students, by and large, home. They're suspended or expelled. And the way we fix this is we do two things. We suspend more white students for like minor things, like they stole a piece of gum, that they should be suspended the same amount of time as a black student who assaulted another with a laptop. That's that kind of, or you don't suspend them at all. You keep them in school because that school to prison pipeline. And that's what they were going for. How do we fix this? Equity, diversity, equity, and inclusion. We need more equity. Bring on more equity, everybody. Just last week, right around the time when this article that Yuri Berliner posted, there's a gentleman by the name of Orenthal James Simpson. Yes, or you might know him as OJ. OJ Simpson, who was very credibly accused of murdering his wife and a waiter, Ron Goldman and Nicole Simpson, Nicole Brown Simpson, in a brutal fashion in June of 1994. Then, of course, we all know about the slow speed chase in the Bronco with Al Collins driving and everyone cheering and interrupting half of the NBA finals at the time between the Rockets and the Knicks. And it was a crazy situation that was going on. Then there was the whole trial, then Mark Furman moving the jurors and jurors having to be dismissed and this and this and this. And what ended up coming out is that the jury knew damn well that OJ did it, but because they felt that the cops in the Rodney King case were dismissed or were acquitted and unfairly acquitted, that this was a retribution, even though most people never really thought of O.J. Simpson as a black man until Johnny Cochran decided, we're going to play up the racial angle here. And that dream team, it worked. So O.J., even though he had to pay the rest of his life in, and I think he owes something like $100 million to the Goldman family in the civil trial, O.J. Simpson has kind of been a weird pariah slash pop culture figure since especially getting out of prison about, 7-8 years ago. Here's how NPR reported his death on their threads. This isn't on Twitter because NPR doesn't use Twitter now after the labeled state-affiliated media. They're not on Twitter. So they use their threads. Remember threads? Remember that week when all those left-wing lunatics like Ron Perlman are like, I'm leaving you MFers for threads. See you later. And then what is he doing? He's still back over on Twitter and barely posting on threads. I'm not on threads. I couldn't care less. I knew it was a passing fad, and I knew it was all lefties that were going to go over there, like people who work at NPR who will post something like this. Breaking news. The football great Orenthal James Simpson, known as OJ, has died. Now, you're probably going to go, hey, what? Anything else? Nope. That's all they posted on their threads. OJ Simpson has died. Football great. He was a football... Technically, yes. O.J. Simpson was a great, in fact, a Hall of Fame running back, ran for 2,000 yards in a season. Incredible. He was all over TV. For people who were too young to remember the O.J. Simpson trial and everything, or O.J. Simpson before the murders in June of 94, O.J. was like Michael Strahan is now. O.J. was on talk shows. He was fun. You almost didn't look at him as a black man. It was, no, it's a gregarious former football player who's doing silly things. And he's in the Naked Gun movies or Towering Inferno, and he's golfing and he's doing a bunch of stuff. Except there's probably something that you miss there, NPR, in your thread. He probably did a couple of other things than just football, right? You could have even said he was an actor. You could say that he was a Twitter personality the last couple of years. Hey, Twitter world, it's yours truly. It's OJ. It's the juice. I'm wearing my Bruno Mars right now, and y'all know what I mean. You missed something. Let's go a little bit more with NPR. A couple of their classic greatest hits in the last couple of years. This one, in the wake of the Roe versus Wade overturning in June of 2022, there was this horrible story. I don't know if you folks might not remember this. I posted the tweet that NPR put out there, but there was a story. It was a really horrible story where I think it was a baby who was burned in the backyard. It was a burned baby. And yet NPR's take on this was it was because of anti-abortion laws, which hadn't even gone into effect at that time. A 41-year-old woman is facing felony charges in Nebraska for allegedly helping her teenage daughter illegally abort a pregnancy. And the case highlights how law enforcement can make use of online communications in the post-Roe versus Wade era. What? What? This had nothing to do with abortion. This wasn't, there weren't two pro-choice activists going like, I want to get an abortion because the baby has Down syndrome or the mother's life is at risk. And they were doing this. There's a little bit more details to this, right? But they didn't post anything about it. So it just makes a lot of us get angry over this stuff. And why you are National Public Radio, yet you're publicly funded. I'm not funding you. Well, I shouldn't be funding you. But this is not representative. You are not framing this the way the public, half of the public, if you want to claim to be an impartial publication, I'm sorry, this is a completely distorted version of this disturbed story. Here's another one. This is, what year is this? This is a couple of years ago, I think. Yeah, 2 years ago. The highest WNBA salary is about $228,000 a year. On the NBA, over $45 million. That stark pay inequity has pushed many WNBA players to play overseas where they can earn more. Mm. So what NPR and what a lot of these places like New York Times and CNN, when they post stuff like this, they're purposely saying, I'm not saying, but I'm just saying. And what I mean by that is they put something out there. When you start attacking them, they're like, no, I'm just that's all we said. Said that there's pay inequity. And that the highest salary you can make is about $250,000 in the WNBA, but the highest you can be in the NBA is $45 million. Why is that? Now, if you want to have the conversation about why that is, because the WNBA is not as good as the NBA. Do you think, I was using the minor league baseball example, do you think a minor league team in, let's say the Tampa Tarpons. I'm going to use this as an example. The Tampa Tarpons, they play at Steinbrenner Field in Tampa, right by Raymond James Stadium and right off Dale Mabry. I've been there a few times. The Tampa Tarpons are a single A team in minor league baseball for the New York Yankees. Some of those guys probably have some signing bonuses, but for the most part, they make very little money, and they're trying to work their way up and work hard, and they're staying with host families, and they get a stipend for their meals and gas and driving and everything like that. Do you think that they deserve to make the kind of money that Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton make? No. And no, they shouldn't. They shouldn't make that kind because they're not as good. They're at a lower, significantly lower level. And also, more people are going to be interested in the New York Yankees than the Tampa Tarpons. Go to Steinbrenner Field. It's a cool field, but its capacity is probably 8,000, and they don't fill that up. I was at a game this week a year ago. I was at a Tampa Tarpons game. There may have been 200 people at this game. But if it's the New York Yankees, they would fill that stadium. Why? Because they're more talented. It's so stupid that I even have to mention this. And they always talk about, the pay gap, you know, the gender pay gap. I'm sure NPR has talked about the pay gap as well. But it's the reason there's a pay gap is men usually take fewer breaks. Men usually take jobs that are way more dangerous. A woman's going to take a little bit more of a motherly job, like secretary, PR executive, babysitter, teacher, nurse, anything like that's a little bit more caretaking, while guys are up on skyscrapers window watching, or they're in coal mines and breathing in, getting black lung. Do you think the coal miner deserves to get paid a little bit more than the secretary at your chiropractor's office? Yeah, I would say so. But that's not how NPR is going to put it out there. They're just saying, they're not saying, they're just saying. Here's another one. This is just a more stupidity. How did we get stuck with the idea that four white guys make a rock band? Why? So again, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. What you're saying is it's a bad thing. No, that's not what we're saying. Yes, you are. You're saying it's a bad thing that we decided that four white guys who are probably smoking pot when they're 17 years old say, hey, man, want to start a band? Yeah, let's do it. Like, I play guitar. It's like, I play some bass. Yeah, I have a drum. My dad has a drum set. And, you know, I could sing. Yeah, let's do it. And apparently, what are you saying? That's racism? That's white supremacy? Because a couple of stoned white dudes in their 20s decide to start a rock band? Okay. It's just more dumb stuff. Yeah, Tom Elliott here responded to that from Graby, and he's like, Michelle Wu, an Asian American, is the first woman and first person of color to lead the city. While many are hailing it as a turning point, others see it as more of a disappointment that the three black candidates couldn't even come close. It's like, wow, you really have a real problem with skin color, don't you? Here's another one, more NPR. I'm just using these as small examples here. I had mentioned this in the piece, but here it is right out in the open, and they still haven't deleted it. This is from December 31st of 2020. A new poll finds 40% of respondents believe in a baseless conspiracy theory that the coronavirus was created in a lab in China. There is zero evidence for this. Scientists say the virus was transmitted to humans from another species. So all the way up until 2021, they were publicly talking about the bats and the pangolins, is that somebody ate bat soup in Wuhan and spread COVID throughout the rest of the world. Except we all know that was BS. That was bullcrap from the beginning. But they pushed it. Boy, did they push it. Here's another NPR. This is great. So the people who promoted lockdowns, school closures, it's not even so much the lockdowns. I mean, yes, the lockdowns were deadly. They were unnecessary at best and deadly at the worst. Evil. Evil lockdowns. And anybody who pushed it, politicians on whatever side of the aisle, local mayors and city executives and city council, all the way to the president of the United States, and that includes Donald Trump. Anyone who is promoting lockdowns needs to be held accountable for these things. Even if you just said 15 days to flatten the curve, many people wanted schools to be closed well into, I'm sure there's probably a very small percentage of the population, but there probably are a few people who think that we shouldn't be sending kids to school now. That kids should be learning remotely, and it's too dangerous to send them into a place with COVID. Okay, whatever. Again, this podcast is probably going to get taken down off of YouTube. We'll get ready for that. I basically got second graders, one fourth grade teacher said after witnessing how disruptive the pandemic was has been to students' development. Academically, we're back to working miracles. And once again, there's Tom Elliott there in the Post says, is there any media outlet singularly responsible for this cataclysm than NPR? And yeah, never. It's like, but grandma, you want a grandma? And we all knew this. Folks, we knew this, but NPR pushed this. Again, how does this represent America? How does any of this represent the pulse of America, what people were thinking about? And you go all the way to 2024, where anyone in the media right now and anyone on television and politicians and others who are saying, guys, you don't understand how great the economy is. I just played a clip last week in the podcast of what's his name from South Carolina, the guy who got Biden elected, James Clyburn. James Clyburn said that social media is to blame. You know, people like Tony Mazur and Twitter and Elon Musk and Joe Rogan. Social media is to blame because the perception that the economy is not doing well is getting out there. Now, according to James Clyburn, the economy is just zipping along. Look at your 401ks. Isn't everything looking so good right now? But the way they look at it is, we are now, people like me, are pushing disinformation that the economy is not great. I mean, you know, don't believe your lying eyes. The fact that your grocery bill that used to be $120 for a grocery trip is now about $250. And the gas is still about $4 a gallon right now. And yeah, there's a couple other things that people can't afford. And then they say, well, the job numbers are up. The jobs are back. See, people are working. Yeah, people are getting government jobs, they're getting public sector jobs, or they're getting second or third jobs. So you could say, like Joe Biden will say, hey, you know, we have a great
job growth. Jobs, there's so many jobs we have. We're just clipping along.
Yeah, of course, you're clipping along that you think that people return to their jobs after not having them when you started. See, when you started, there were a lot of people who were still out of work, wondering when they were going to get their job, that they were on unemployment or, I don't know, sitting around waiting for work to pop up for them. And then many got lazy and didn't return to the workforce, but a lot of people did. They had to make a couple of bucks. Their unemployment was running up, so they returned to work. Well, the Biden administration counted that as a job. Oh, okay. And then people are like, well, no one's hiring full-time, and the full-time places are, it's salary-driven, and they're going to make me work a lot of hours. So I'm getting a second, a third, and even a fourth job to make ends meet right now. And all that is just cha-ching, 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 four jobs. Well, look at this. We created four jobs. Or you're getting government jobs. You get TSA, ridiculous, nonsense government public sector jobs. But places like NPR are not reporting that. Places like NPR would report that you're too stupid to understand what Joe Biden, his administration, what they've been putting out there. You have to understand, Tony, that they know what's going on. The fact that you're just sitting there mouthing off with your disinformation, your misinformation, your malinformation. See, the COVID, the lab leak thing was malinformation. It was, if you said there was a lab leak in, April or May of 2020, it was true. It's just, it was an uncomfortable truth at the time, which is called malinformation. That's places like NPR would do that. But yeah, the worst part about that, because I think the Holy Trinity, because it covers all three outlets, TV, radio, and newspapers, New York Times, CNN, and NPR, all three of them in the last couple of years have really been shown their asses. Absolutely. They've been shown what frauds they are. They've been shown what evil people they are by posting any of this garbage. All of it. Everything they've been putting out there has a liberal bias. Now, again, normal circumstances, people should look to NPR, to New York Times, to CNN as they push the news. There are still a lot of people who believe that, but it's dwindling by the day. They have lost the trust in America. America does not look at NPR as, wow, you know, I'm going to go into the 90.3, long on the dial, and I'm going to listen to my NPR station. Now, they're going to their own echo chambers in a lot of ways, and we shouldn't have had to do that, but you just absolutely lost the trust of America. People did go to those outlets because they wanted that information until many started figuring out that you were lying to them. There were a lot of people, probably were NPR listeners, that would sit there and go, I can't believe Donald Trump colluded with Vladimir. He's Putin's puppet. And they're still talking about that. There's still many people who think that Donald Trump is a puppet of Putin. I was at my job the other day, and they're like, one of my coworkers was looking at the TV going, boy, him and Russia, they got some weird relationship. What? What are you talking about? Oh, wait. That's right. You have an NPR sticker. You're an NPR viewer. You are voting for Joe Biden because NPR told you to do so. That's at the beginning of that piece that I showed there. As they said that instead of telling listeners what to think, they told them how to think. And a lot of people don't feel that way. They don't want to be told to think a certain way. Many do. I would say 35% of the people would, if NPR posted something like something outrageous about Donald Trump, they will believe it. In fact, I'm sure NPR, if I went through even more of the archives, they probably have that Steele dossier, which again was all a lie, but they ran with it. Donald Trump likes getting peed on by hookers on a bed because Barack Obama once stayed there years earlier. They ran with that. There's no evidence that that ever happened. Yet you talk to your normal NPR listener, if you mention the Steele dossier, they'd be like, oh, yeah, though, when the hookers were peeing on Trump, yeah, that never happened. How do you know it didn't happen? Here's how I know it didn't happen. Because if it did, we would have heard about it and seen it by now. Just infuriating. But yeah, again, it's not representative of America anymore. And it's time for these places to just absolutely go away. It's kind of interesting with the blowback of that piece by Yuri Berliner. Because it says, on the calls to defund NPR, Yuri Berliner specifically said that he would be that would be wrong, that many local public radio stations depend on federal funding and are the only sources of local news in their community. He said that this was a nonpartisan matter. It should be not nonpartisan, And the nonpartisan part about it is it that piece that he wrote, a 25-year veteran of NPR saying, our place lost their way. That should wake a lot of people up into realizing that. But your average NPR listener is not going to read that and go, gosh, I've been lied to. I'm not going to listen to them anymore. No more $5 donations to them so I can get a tote bag or a coffee mug. Oh, I'm not going to, that's not going to happen. No. NPR is a liberal echo chamber. So the people probably who read that said, yeah, no, that's fine. No, what's the problem? They have a liberal bent? Well, I have a liberal bent, so it's okay. It's news for me. The same people, of course, get mad at Fox News for being too right-wing. Fox News, oh, those right-wingers, they don't report the news. Well, neither does NPR. But you have to look at it through their lens of what they've been trying to push. And what they've been pushing for a long time now is this left-wing bent, and what they're doing is they're honestly signaling to their audience. Again, it's not the farmer on the tractor that they mentioned earlier in that piece. A farmer is not waking up and listening to Morning Edition or All Things Considered or Car Talk or I don't even know what's on NPR anymore. I remember listening to it. My uncle, he might be listening to this, but my uncle was a professor out at Chico State, California. We were out in California one time going from Chico to Sacramento. And we're driving and he had NPR on. And I wanted to just unlock the car and roll out. This was 15 years ago. It was 2009, right after Obama was elected. And it was boring. And you could just tell who these people are that are giving the news. Like, honestly, you're not going to listen to a newscaster on NPR. I'm saying a normal NPR listener is not going to listen to a newscast if you have somebody who has this tattoo. I have a We the People tattoo on my arm. If I were giving you the news and you saw a We the People tattoo, an NPR listener is going to go, he's going to go have a bias on him. He's going to have a right-wing conservative pro-Trump, pro-QAnon, pro-this, pro-that bias. I'm not going to listen to that. Well, that's kind of how a lot of people feel with NPR, that their presenters are usually left-wingers. They're Elizabeth. Actually, you know, I mentioned Elizabeth Warren earlier because I'm not going to talk trash about her, but I had an ex-girlfriend who was a big Elizabeth Warren supporter. She fit the mold of an NPR viewer. She had the Warby Parker glasses. She was a left-wing journalist in college and worked at a couple of newspaper publications locally, and purple hair and tattoos and that kind of stuff. And that's what the typical NPR listener is. And she was a massive, massive Elizabeth Warren supporter. Okay, but if there were so many supporters of hers in the media, and I would say if you polled anybody at NPR, Elizabeth Warren would be president. If you only gave them ballots in 2020, even before COVID, if you gave NPR staff a ballot and who they would vote for, I guarantee you it was not Joe Biden. It certainly wasn't Bernie Sanders. It would have been Elizabeth Warren. But Elizabeth Warren, the reason why she never finished above fourth or fifth place in any of these primaries was because she's not representative of America. She represents a small cadre of overly educated, not street smart, but book smart, East Coast, maybe some like Berkeley, San Francisco, maybe parts of LA, but coastal elites that, again, have their pronouns in their bio, that still wear masks at the grocery store, that are okay with putting a chip in their arm or in their hand and paying for their groceries by waving their hand in front of the scanner, who have talked for how many years about the evils of capitalism while there's 9 packages from Amazon on your front porch. I mean, it's a typical person who listens to NPR. It's not people like me anymore. We all know that the scab has been ripped off. So NPR has 2 options right now. NPR could either go, guys, we lost the people. How do we regain this in a world where there's just so much media oversaturation? We have all of these different outlets that people can go to, their own echo chambers that you don't even have to live in the present day. You could watch videos. I can watch sports. I talk about it all the time. I can watch sports from 1987, before I was born, 1987 on YouTube, full games. Oh, it's the Chicago Cubs versus the St. Louis Cardinals at Busch Stadium, and it's Harry Carey's on the call, and I can watch that. There's games on right now that are playing right now, yet I'm watching a game from 37 years ago. Why? Because I can. And you're allowed to do that. So when you when you're in this where everybody has their own podcast, some have several podcasts, there's so many different options for entertainment and education. NPR could do two things. One, they could look at the error of their ways and say, how do we regain the trust of the average American? I think we probably should be putting our stuff out there and getting away from having a liberal bias, getting away from the typical NPR supporter and kind of guide them back towards the middle again. Or do what they're continuing to do by saying that, oh, you stopped watching porn? Well, then you're a white supremacist. Oh, you think being on time for work? Oh, you think that that's right? Well, that's actually white supremacy because you don't understand the plight of Black and brown Americans who have to deal with dreams of white supremacy and that they toss and turn, can't get good night's sleep. I mean, this is what NPR is doing. So if you want to continue going down that road, okay, but I don't want to fund it. That's why NPR should have been defunded yesterday. Defund NPR. I'm fine with it going away. I'm fine with the New York Times going away. I'm fine with CNN going away. The good news, if we want to hear about any good news in this, who's returning to NPR? Who's returning to the New York Times? Who's returning to CNN? Some people have talked, I've talked about this on the Patreon podcast as well, but let's say you were a big Alex Jones fan and you watch InfoWars, you like Owen Schroyer and you like Elijah Schaefer and everybody else who's on that network as well as Alex Jones. Well, if Alex Jones, let's just say part of one of the Sandy Hook settlement that he had to give up InfoWars, it had to shut down. If you're an InfoWars viewer and listener, and you have a t-shirt and you have a sticker on the back of your car that says InfoWars or Biden for prison or whatever they have in their store right now, or all the supplements that he sells, are you going back to CNN? If Alex Jones went away, or your favorite podcast, this podcast, if the Daily Wire shows or the Blaze shows, if all those places just closed up shop tomorrow, the listeners are not going to sit there and go, huh, shoot, boy, my favorite show, my favorite podcasts are gone. Well, looks like I'm watching Wolf Blitzer tonight. Looks like Jake Tapper is going to be on my docket right now. I have no choice. Look, I work hard. I got to fill that time. No. They're going to find something similar and probably even more radical. So that's what's going on right now. You're not going to put that toothpaste back in the tube. Those viewers, those listeners are not, and readers are not going back to traditional media anymore. It's a joke. It's old school. The people who are only propping them up are boomers. That's what's going on. Even the blue-haired pronouns, tattooed, live, laugh, love tattoos on your chest, transgendered individual who's 20, you'd say, oh, that sounds like an NPR listener, except they're not. They're not listening to NPR. They're listening to, the only people listening to NPR are Gen Xers on podcasts and boomers on the radio. Outside of that, kind of goes away. Kind of goes away, and it will go away. If you thought Bed Bath & Beyond was not going to survive, you didn't think Bed Bath & Beyond was going to go away by this time, did you? A lot of people didn't think Blockbuster or Sears or Kmart, these places would go on forever. All of them have become punchlines and become nostalgic punchlines or jokes overall. There you go. Oh, man, remember Blockbuster? Yeah, Be Kind, Rewind. We used to do that back in the day. Well, that's what we're going to look at these outlets. And I don't know how long. It could be 5, 10, 20, 25, 30 years from now. But we're going to look back at these days of, hey, remember when people actually watched that CNN stuff? Oh, yeah, that was terrible. It was garbage. Remember when they followed that Malaysian airline and they wouldn't stop talking about it even when everybody else did? They hitched on to that story thinking that they had a bombshell. And if anything, it just turned into a joke. Oh, yeah, that outlet. It's gone. Can you believe it? Man, remember we used to read the New York Times? What happened to it? Remember we used to call it the New York Slimes? Oh, this is so funny. Yeah, that's kind of gone. It's all gone. Eventually, it'll go away, and hopefully sooner rather than later. It's just the difference is between New York Times, CNN, and NPR is NPR is taxpayer-funded. It's publicly funded. And sure, maybe your local NPR station that they have their national syndication, but then they have a couple of local shows. Do they do some good work? I don't know. I'm not even going to give them the benefit of the doubt by saying, oh, I'm sure they do a pretty good job at covering the, you know, the local shortage on pork and grain and the farms. And yeah, I'm not even going to give them the benefit of the doubt because I would assume they're going to talk about how there was a grain shortage and it has to do with Donald Trump and white supremacy. That's kind of what's been going on right now with NPR. And that's why it needs to be defunded. It should have been defunded decades ago. Defund it right now. Defund it already. Defund NPR. Make it go the way of the dodo bird. Thanks, everybody, for listening to today's podcast, the Check Your Brain podcast. Again, if you are watching for free, go to, I have many more episodes. There's my podcast logo again on the major podcast platforms like Apple, like Spotify, like iHeart, like Pandora. I'm on there as well, or Amazon and all of those places, as well as Rumble. Once a week, I try to get an episode for you on Rumble, as well as for right now, after they heard me talk about COVID a bunch of times here, I'm going to get some strike, I'm assuming, with this video over on my YouTube page. But if you want more content that you hear with this, just with a lot more F-bombs, as my buddy, I mess with the Fred Sanford when I say it's my saucier content, where I'd let the language go a little bit more. Go to patreon.com/Tony Mazur. My name is Tony Mazur. Thank you for listening and even watching this podcast. I'll be back with you with another free episode of this show coming up to you next week. Bye, everyone.